Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Neuro Experience Podcast. I'm Louisa. I'm the host. I hope you're excited for today's episode. I am joined by powerhouse Dr. Jordan Shallow. He's a multifaceted expert, if I do say so myself. He's traditionally a chiropractor, but he's also a strength and conditioning and performance consultant. Not only is he the founder and CEO of Prescript, but he's also the medical director for House of Athlete, and he co-hosts his own radio show. With a background that includes being the former chiropractor at Apple World Headquarters and the head strength and conditioning coach for the Stanford University rugby team, Jordan is a force to be reckoned with. He consults with professional sports teams to integrate training and rehab models and works as a clinician and strength coach with some of the top athletes in the NFL, NHL, and UFC. Go and have a look at his Instagram. You'll see just how incredibly amazing this man is. He's absolutely, he stunned me with his intelligence. You'll see in this episode that I probably asked him around five questions, and he just was amazing. I learned so much, and I know you will too. We focused a lot on biomechanics, and we hone in on some of the misconceptions in the fitness industry when it comes to rehab, injuries, and sports performance as it pertains to biomechanics. I know there's a lot of mess out there on Instagram, so we clear a lot of things up. We talk about where the fitness industry is failing due to lack of knowledge in these areas, and then we really take an approach to recovery. I asked him questions like, what are the best recovery methods for athletes? And we also come about this from a general population perspective, so everyone can get something from this episode. I hope you enjoyed it just as much as I did. And remember, please go through and write a written review or rate us on Apple Podcasts. It helps get these wonderful guests out there. It helps the Neuro Experience Podcast and our community. Without further delay, let's move into the episode. I'd love to understand just a bit more about what you're doing, because just like me, like neurophysiology, I marry the two. I marry that aspect, neurology, brain performance, with elite athleticism. So I'm guessing that you're doing the same in terms of you're just getting an athlete stronger and injury-free.
It's so case by case, but there's kind of like three major subcomponents of how, like, I look at, assess, and address an athlete, whether that's post-op, whether that's, someone who's not injured, looking to optimize performance and, you know, kind of look at gait cycle mechanics, look at ventilation mechanics, and ultimately look at the central nervous system, the brain, and motor learning. And we just kind of see, like, where are we deficient in those three and how those three kind of intersect and sort of orbit each other. And then we just create a list of priorities based off of where they're at, where they need to be, and the timeline they need to be there. And we, you know, we try and fly it as close to the sun as possible in like a principles-based approach. And, you know, every day is just, you know, there's no protocols. It's not necessarily a step-by-step process that we follow, but it's like a systems way of thinking rather than an actual system itself, which is, it's the only way that we can accelerate the process in usually the compressed time frames that we have. And then let's maybe get to sprinkle in a little bit of experience and a little bit of, you know, the player's preference. And then you kind of get this cool little modern day evidence-based way of practicing and, you know, both from the rehab spectrum, from the corrective exercise all the way up to like just the exercising correctly and, you know, performance optimization.
A special thank you to today's sponsor, Timeline Nutrition. I especially love Timeline Nutrition's products because they have something really special inside them. They have urolithin A. So as we age, it's really important to understand that the human body and the brain, of course, becomes less efficient in many ways. And oftentimes when we talk about efficiency, we're often referring to the efficiency of our mitochondria. Mitochondria are the energy generating components in our body. And they become damaged as we age, making it harder to produce energy. Urolithin A is the primary compound found in MitoPure from Timeline Nutrition. So this is a science-backed product which has decades of peer-reviewed published science, which is why I'm super excited to be part of the Timeline Nutrition team, especially as it relates to brain mitochondrial health. They have a beautiful product line that's low in sugar, non-GMO, and many gluten-free choices. You can mix your MitoPure berry or ginger powder, which is great if you have any digestive issues, into your favorite smoothie. Timeline is offering our community 10% off your first order of MitoPure. Just go to timelinenutrition.com/neuro and use code NEURO, N-E-U-R-O, to get 10% off your order. That's timelinenutrition.com/neuro. Use code NEURO and you'll get 10% off your order. I'd also like to thank the second sponsor of today's episode, Element. Now, you guys know that I speak about electrolytes, and that's because electrolytes are key to cellular function, in particular, nerve cell and neuronal cell function. So I'm a huge advocate for proper hydration, no matter how much you sweat. And the best electrolyte solution right now is Element, which is an electrolyte drink. It's spelled L-M-N-T. So back when I was a triathlete, I thought that electrolytes were only needed if you were some big sweater. But it turns out that every person needs electrolytes. And Element is a science-backed formula with 1,000 milligrams of sodium, 200 milligrams of potassium, 60 milligrams of magnesium, and no junk. So it's perfect for keto, low-carb, and paleo diets. It's trusted by pro athletes and fitness enthusiasts. I frankly drink 2.5 liters of water a day, and that can be hard. So I've been throwing in some electrolytes, and I got to tell you, it makes my day a whole lot easier. So if you want to try this, it's completely risk-free. In fact, even if you don't like the flavors, you can send them back and get your money back. So head on over to drinkelement.com/neuro. Go through, check them out. A little hint, the strawberry and the chocolate are my favorites. That's drinkelement.com/neuro and use code NEURO at checkout.
I know this is just a crazy question. I don't know if you've ever gotten this. What's the difference between a physical therapist and a chiropractor?
You know, that is a great question. And I feel that more often, I feel that so often I should have a better answer. I would say from a scope of practice perspective, they're fairly similar on paper, but oftentimes the way they practice is very different. You know, the conventional chiropractor is very focused on majority spinal manipulation, some spinal and extremity manipulation. It's part of a scope of practice. A physical therapist would probably call it a level 5 mobilization or high velocity, low amplitude mobilization. I know physical therapists that adjust. I know chiropractors that use ice and heat and stim. One just seems to be more hated in the public eye than the other. And hey, I'm not here to defend. I'm not an elected official, but that's like kind of the major differences around the efficacy and the effectiveness and the dosage of spinal and extremity manipulation. I would say that's kind of the main cornerstone difference between the two.
Yeah. But one of the things I think that you both professions believe in, or something that I've heard you speak a lot about, is stability. And stability being at the forefront of movement, of motor learning, correct me if I'm wrong, of athletic performance. So I'd love to understand what your take is on stability, because I know that you're about to give us a bit of an anatomy crash course right now.
Yeah. And I think it's one thing that if there's a common ground between chiropractors and physical therapists, athletic trainers, and you know, really any manual medicine rehabilitation specialty or subspecialty, it's probably the misunderstanding around stability as a separate stimulus and what are the actual mechanisms at play. A lot of times we conflate, and it's not always to the detriment of the client, but I think when you're dealing with like a high performing population, you're dealing with like the 1% of 1% of like physical specimens on the planet, like novelty and exercise induced analgesia when it comes to pain reduction just doesn't fly. it just doesn't work. But we have so much validation and self-serving bias of deploying these, you know, let's call them strengthening strategies, which is like, you know, putting muscle tension or putting fibers across or tension across muscle fibers, moving it from insertion to origin, strengthening a rotator cuff, strengthening a glute, strengthening a core, strengthening a piriformis. And just, you know, we've heard it 1,000 times. You go into a physio or you go into even a chiro, like, oh, you know, I think you have a weak this, that, or the other. And then, well, weakness is going to then directly indicate that the solution be strength. And, you know, we know how to strengthen our quads. We know how to strengthen our biceps. We know how to strengthen our hamstrings. We move from insertion to origin. We put this muscle, we put this mechanical tension across muscle fibers. And as, you know, one of the byproducts or one of the results of that is an increase in ability to produce force. And for 90 whatever percent of the population that's not physically active, introducing a novel stimulus to a rotator cuff, to, you know, a lumbar spine, to a hip or pelvis, that novel stimulus of strength, you know, whether it's like the green TheraBand or whether it's like the bands around the knees or whether it's like a curl up or a side plank or a bird dog, that and those are probably poor examples, the last three, but that novel stimulus is enough to be like, oh, this person was in pain. We had a working hypothesis or like a differential diagnosis that one of those causes of pain could have been a relative like weakness or instability, and we deployed these strengthening exercises. So I think like the first thing to kind of parse out is the difference between strength and stability. So when I say strength, I'm talking about like go to the gym, you want stronger pecs, you move the lateral lip of the bicipital groove closer to the medial two-thirds border of the clavicle, sternum, and lower ribs, right? So like you just shorten the pec and lengthen the pec and shorten the pec. Whereas, you know, if you have issues with the rotator cuff isn't primarily focused on just shortening, right? And I think one thing that people miss is that muscles are sensory organs, right? And they're not just contractile tissue that are attempting to shorten always, right? Which is, you know, in certain situations, that's true, but there's always a latent sensory component to a muscle contraction that's giving a motor output locally at the muscle, but it's also giving a sensory input, a sensory feedback globally at the brain. Right. So when we look at stability, it's kind of like two ends of the spectrum. You know, you could have like an unstable shoulder, an unstable spine, an unstable hip joint, knee, whatever. A lot of like stability will break down internally between structure and function. Right. So like a shoulder, for example, is not structurally stable. Right, the glenoid rest or the humeral head resting in the glenoid does not have a lot of articulating surface area, right? The whole, like, it's like a golf ball and a tee. So there's a great potential for functional stability. And that sounds like a bad word. It sounds like gimmicky. And I get it. Like the industry's at a point now where like functional stability is it's kind of like meaningless and nebulous in nature. But if we think of like, okay, function would be our ability to you know, use our nervous system to call on muscles, to pull on tendons, to, you know, rearrange the relative orientation of our skeleton, right? So that would be like a function. And when I say structure, I think more passive. I think about the skeleton itself. So like the ability to overcome or like outfunction like bad structure at like an ankle joint is way less than the ability to outfunction bad structure at a shoulder joint. Ankle joint, you know, some regular bones, you know, navicular, cuneiforms, cuboids, calcaneus, talus, metatarsal heads. You have all of these bones and like some this web network of ligaments that tie it all together. I can't tell you like, hey, Louise, I want you to contract your anterior talofibular ligament, right? Which is the most commonly sprained ligament of the ankle. It's structure, right? It's inert. It's not hooked up to the mainframe. So, you know, we want to look at the opportunities to really tap into that functional piece. And stability allows us, if we understand at like a local level, what the mechanism is at play, as well as what is the mechanism at play at the global level. That's where I think a lot of people miss the boat. So they're either going to go down the one route of like, oh, you have like an unstable shoulder. We're going to strengthen the rotator cuff or the serratus, which leaves you doing like external rotation drills or protraction pushups. And again, there's a subset of the population that will benefit from that. But, you know, when we start to deal with higher performing athletes who are resisting force at high velocities or for long durations or at high intensities, the TheraBand external rotation doesn't really hold up. That novel stimulus, that exercise-induced analgesia, doesn't scale to the level of their nervous system capacity. So then we need to identify, like, okay, well, what are the tenets of stability as a separate stimulus? And that comes down to base support and center of mass, which I'm sure we could get into later. So, and the flip side of that, just to kind of wrap this up, because I know I've been rambling, is the flip side of that is extra physiological instability, right? This is where we see Bosu balls. This is where we see like emergency room, Swiss ball, back squat, just nightmare. It's like, okay, there's a happy medium in the middle where load is still important. Now, we're not moving load from insertion to origin. We're using load to manipulate center of mass and base support to elicit a stimulus of instability so that a joint is resisting force, not exerting force. That'd be like a definition difference between the two. Strength is our ability to exert force. Stability is our ability to resist force. Right. So we kind of have that major difference there. But the load is still important. A load is still important in eliciting a meaningful local, which will then stimulate the global sensory input that we want to derive from this. Load is still important. Like load is the vehicle for a process called like mechanotransduction, which takes external stimulus and turns it into little electrical impulses that allows for the local and global benefits to be derived. So a lot of times when you enter in extra physiological instability, Bosu balls, med balls, all this standing on like blue pads and all that, it's like, let's see if the person can stand on just like the ground first. And 9 times, 10 times out of 10, they can't. Right. So that's like,
yeah,
that's a split in the road. Stability is different than strength. Stability is our ability to resist force, not exert force. But it's don't go so far as to think, oh, okay, some instability good, extra physiological instability better. It's not a dose dependent relationship like most things in the body, right? We kind of fall on this inverted or this bell curve distribution where rotator cuff strengthening, meh, but you know, balancing, a beach ball on your nose while you juggle Rubik's cubes or whatever people are doing, also not good. And the middle seems to be the most potent stimulus you can get that's different than strength and isolation.
With saying all of this, then, what's the absolute starting point? Is it literally, let's get a patient or a client and let's just get them to stand on the ground and let's maybe push them and check their stability and just say that they've scored a, I don't know what your scoring system is. Let's say they've scored a 10 out of 10. You've said they're pretty stable. What's the next move from there?
So I guess maybe it's not as simple as that. So progressing instability is going to be two components. It's going to be minimizing base support and center of mass, right? So if I deviate a center of mass, I can make something more unstable. Example. If I'm standing on the gym floor, I have both feet on the ground and I place a 150-pound dumbbell in my right hand. I'll have deviated the combined center of mass of me and the dumbbell. Mm-hmm. Now I'm unstable, right? I have, you know, a frontal plane movement, starting to resist force, like QL, my adductors, things like that, glute med, and all that. So stopping me from moving side to side. That's one way. The other way is to minimize base support. If I simply stand on one leg, I will become less stable, right? So I guess, where do we start with someone? Your skeleton is going to tell you how you interact with gravity, right? So to the very, like, and I don't want to say posture is something that I spend a lot of time on looking at, like from a static perspective. I don't look at someone and be like, well, they have an anterior orientation of their pelvis or this, that, and the other, because I'm really only concerned with the lifting posture that's congruent with the mechanics of the exercise that I'm trying to train. Right. So, you know, static posture as an assessment, I think, is a little bit of a red herring. So we kind of have these two, as I mentioned earlier, these two like subdivisions that we're going to look at from an upper extremity perspective. Mm-hmm. Rib cage mechanics is driven by ventilation patterns is probably going to be a really good starting point for the upper extremity. I think of it this way. You grew up in Australia, so it's probably similar to Canada. Like in the 10th grade, you learn how to create like just little circular depictions of periodic table elements. So you have like the nucleus, which is like whatever.
Yeah.
Well, let's so say it's lithium, right? So like hydrogen, helium,
controls
the third one.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like, okay, we have like the nucleus, mm-hmm. we have the first valence, which is going to be like the first valence in this case would be, so the nucleus is the diaphragm, the first valence is going to be the rib cage, and the second valence is going to be the scapula, and the mm-hmm. third valence is going to be the humerus. So everything kind of starts from the diaphragm's preference in how it contracts based off of the shape of the rib cage. So that's like starting point number one from the upper extremity perspective, is kind of going, pulling on that thread and seeing like, okay, are you limited by your structure? So some people have like me, like I have like a super wide rib cage, better at sagittal plane movements. Competitive powerlifting is sort of my calling, where someone like Lance Armstrong, very cylindrical, very like aerobic shape to his rib cage, has a lot of ability to expand posteriorly, fill up his lungs, more like much more aerobic in his shape, much better at transverse plane movements, right? So that's kind of like where we start from the upper extremity. The lower extremity, we look at gait cycle. I think the word function, as I alluded to earlier, is oftentimes looked at as a bad word because it's a marketing tool, right? Like, oh, get your functional trainer. And it's like, I don't know, camo suspension training straps that you attach to a tree branch or whatever. It's like, that's not, function has to mean something as human beings, right? So I think the definition of function, I think, is a good thing to unify from a language perspective. And for me, when I talk about function, I'm referring to how a muscle or even the skeleton is going to behave when we walk and breathe. And not necessarily in that order. I think ventilation supersedes in importance, at least for upper extremity. Gait cycle, but gait cycle is obviously like an evolved process that we do better than anyone else, right? Any other creature on the planet when it comes to like being biped ambulatory. Like if you look at a black bear walking on its back legs, it's like, it's scary because it's 7 feet tall and 450 pounds, but it's like, it kind of looks goofy, right? Like you see it, and I don't know if you've ever seen a black bear, but you're like, oh, that's cute. And then it like kills seven people or something. But we do bipedal ambulation like scary good, like really good. And one of the things that makes us interesting is that we have an ability to break apart our gait cycle and our ventilation cycle, right? So if you think of like a quadruped animal, I don't know, like a tiger, or if you go to, if you go to like the Great Migration and you watch a bunch of zebra run across in nature's craziest game of Red Rover, every time they take a step, they have to take a breath, right? Because of the orientation of the diaphragm and the horizontal orientation of the guts and the fact that, yeah, they have these front legs that have a deceleration component that compresses the rib cage every stride or gallop or canter. That's different than us, right? Like Usain Bolt is a classic example. He runs 100 meters in 9.58 seconds. He does it in 41 strides, which is on average like 4 to 5 strides less than the next fastest sprinter in the world. But he takes 4 breaths, right? If that was any other animal, they'd be inefficient. That's what one of the reasons we're an apex predator. So, you know, looking at that, it's like, okay, these are two really important processes, right? Gait cycle and ventilation. So from a lower extremity perspective, looking at someone's response to different phases of gait is a really good starting point, right? So gait cycle.
Break that down for me. So different responses to gait cycle. So break that down for me. What is that?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And this is like right now, my day to day. So like I work a lot with football players. Football players have a predisposition to move horizontally because the end zone is that way. It's never straight down. I mean, it is when they're in the end zone, but other than that, their goal is to move their pelvis horizontally. And now depending on their position, some guys look more like me, like a little bit wider. Linemen, linebackers, and some people are a little bit narrower, right? These are like your defensive ends. These are your wide receivers. So to some degree, like your running back. Now, the nature of the game is to move horizontally, not to move vertically. So that gives us a predisposition to how they're going to distribute their center of mass. Here's like kind of an example. And we're going to go off a little bit of tangent, but I promise I'll bring it back. Have you seen the Netflix documentary about Boeing? Have you seen that?
Boeing, no.
Boeing there. Okay, so I travel like a lot, like an inordinate amount.
Yeah.
And so I've got fascinated with airplanes over the last couple of years. So I'll kind of give a brief synopsis of this documentary and I'll tie it into this example about, okay, the end goal of this will be, can we describe how we use gait cycle and what assessments we use to understand how people bias different parts of gait cycle? So that's the end goal. So we're going to put this up here. I'm going to go off on a rant and hopefully end back at this location. So in this documentary, they talk about an aircraft called an Airbus A320. Well, technically, the technical term is called the Airbus A320neo. Now, the Neo term came from adopting a new engine style or a new engine altogether, actually a much larger engine that was more fuel efficient. So Airbuses tend to, all of them, their entire fleet, tend to rest higher off of the ground when on the runway. So they had clearance to take this new engine from America and put it underneath the wing. No problem. minimal change in pitch, right? Minimal change in the center of mass of the aircraft, right? The weight was a little bit different, but nothing too drastic. Enter Boeing. Boeing now sees their greatest competitor, Airbus, has this new, more efficient, more effective engine. They go, okay, we need to get our hands on that. And so they call the company, they get their hands on it. The problem is they don't have the same level of clearance on the runway. One way you can kind of tell a Boeing from an Airbus is Airbuses are like a little bit taller and Boeings are a little bit like shorter to the ground. So what they did was they attached this new engine, but the way that it attached, part of the engine is actually above the wing. Now, if you fly a lot, you'll notice the engines are like directly underneath the wing. So what ended up happening was the Airbus engine would fit nice snug underneath, just as the previous engine did in the old 320. The Boeing, so the Boeing was called, this, they called the new Boeing the 737 Max 8. So it had this new engine on it, but the engine, because it didn't fit underneath, had some of it that was above the wing, drastically changing the center of mass, the aerodynamics of the plane. So Boeing kind of knew this, and what they did was they put in this system, the short form was the MCAS system. I swear this has to do with biomechanics. So the interesting thing about this is it was an automated system that tried to calculate and recalibrate automatically the position of the plane relative to the change in pitch of the plane based off of the fact that part of the engine was above the wing. And they didn't really tell many people about it. So like they made retraining on the new aircraft very short. There was like a little blurb about it. And most pilots didn't really know how to make any adjustments based off of this. So they were kind of told, hey, look, this new great plane, it competes with the 320neo. All good. Off you go. Until a bunch of people started dying and these planes started falling out of the sky. Mm-hmm. Because what was happening was anytime they were taking off, they were the sensor, this MCAS system, was reading that they were at a different elevation than where they actually were. Right. So sometimes they were reading that their nose was too up and this MCAS system kicked in and started to pull the nose down. Right. But the fact of the matter was the plane was flying just fine. Right? The system was off. It was reading the center of mass wrong. And so it started pulling the nose down when the plane didn't have an upward trajectory, right? So then it started obviously like downing aircraft. And the more they tried to correct against it and pull the plane up, the more the software fought against them and put the plane down, right? Leading to, I think, two major crashes that were pretty well documented and like a huge, you know, pain in the ass, obviously, for Boeing and for everyone involved. Your body works a lot like that. Our central nervous system, one of the preoccupations of being a bipedal ambulatory creature is don't fall over. We have a lot of systems that write us with the horizon, right? Like with our eyes, we're very visual creatures, like I'm sure as you know. And so we have something that manages and monitors tone automatically or autonomically to make sure we don't fall over, constantly calibrating for how we carry our center of mass over our base of support, right? So I think of like, you know, some of our offensive linemen that we work with are like 350, 360 pounds. And you can imagine how they might walk, right? You know, they have their feet flared out when they walk into a room. They kind of have like this global extension tone through their entire torso and thorax. And what they're doing is they're constantly trying to bring their center of mass back. That's why they're extending their spine. And they're trying to broaden their base of support. They're trying to make themselves more stable. Right? Because they're fighting this fight against gravity, just as the airplane or the Airbus or the Boeing was fighting its fight against gravity. And the nervous system acts as this MCAS system and trying to calibrate the skeleton so it does not fall over. So what was the objective? The objective was to tie this into gait cycle. Right. Okay. So if we think about a football player who's always moving horizontally, we can kind of say that, look, they're always carrying their center of mass forward. Right? They're always leaning forward. That's why they purport to have tight calves and tight hamstrings, that the hamstrings are tearing all the time. They have tight glutes. They have this whole tight extensor chain down the back of their spine. Because to them, they enter a room and they're just walking totally upright. But when we get good at identifying how people carry their center of mass, you actually see that the MCAS system in their brain is so active because they are always, in their mind, they're actually falling forward, right? The nervous system is activating these extensors to kind of pull them upright with the horizon, right? So the goal is to then have the hardware match the software, right? To put them in positions where they can calibrate their center of mass. So like, what does this look like? When we start to break down gait cycle, maybe let's start with that first. gait cycle is two major phases, right? So there's like a stance phase with our foot on the ground, and then there's a swing phase with our foot in the air, right? So while you're in stance phase of one, you're likely in some phase of swing phase of the other. So from an athletic perspective, we're really worried about what goes on with the foot on the ground, where we're, you know, either absorbing, producing, or transferring force. So one thing that you'll run into with football players, and not just exclusively, but it's an example that I see every day, is if this is my foot, right, using my hand, the heel of my hand or the heel of my foot, this is like early stance mechanics, right? So if I'm just walking around, I should heel strike, yep, where I absorb force, I then produce force at mid stance, and I transfer force in terminal stance. So I kind of use like my hind foot, my mid foot, and my forefoot to absorb, produce, and transfer force. If you're a football player and you're just always running forward, you don't have time for literally none of those things. Well, you have time for all of them, but you just do them all in one place. They're always on their toes. And they think that's why their calves are tight and their hamstrings are tight, because they're kind of living on their toes and they're moving horizontally and they're carrying their center of mass forward. It's not the case. They can take someone. Let's take an exercise like a single leg RDL. Very basic. Now, if we look at gait cycle, single leg RDL should be a frontal plane movement. And this might lose some people right away. So if they're familiar with the planes of movement, we have sagittal, which is front to back, frontal, which is side to side, and then transverse, which is rotational. They become increasingly more complex to organize as we move from one plane to the next. Sagittal plane, very simple. Frontal plane, side to side, a little bit more complex. And then transverse plane rotation is the most complex. That's why whenever you turn on the highlight reel from any sporting event, it's probably going to be high velocity transverse plane movement, because it's the most complicated thing to figure out, right? That's why powerlifting doesn't make it onto ESPN's top 10, because it's sagittal plane movement and it's kind of slow. It's a little bit heavy, but people care less about endurance, a little bit more about intensity, and a lot about velocity in sports. And so that's how like stimuli track and complexity as well. So if we have like frontal or sagittal plane endurance, boring, no one cares. But if we have high velocity transverse plane, a lot of people care, right? And you can literally base like the highest velocity transverse plane movement to me would probably be sprinting. There's a ton of rotation involved in sprinting. I digress, kind of back on track. So when we pick an exercise like a single leg RDL, okay, I stand on one leg, I have a slight bend on my stance leg knee. A good way, and this is like a really good tool that we'll use, is I just need to get, I have objective technique criteria, and I'm going to superimpose that over subjective feedback, right? So I have an idea of how I want this to look, and I have an idea of what I want to hear. And those two things are really important, because we can have two athletes who carry their center of mass differently, or one is able to wield their center of mass and one is not. Let's probably put it that way. And they can get in the exact same position with the same relative anthropometry, same size and shape, and one can feel one thing and one can feel a complete other. And that feeling is very useful for us, right? Because that feeling is telling us how it is that they're applying force based off of the way they carry the center of mass, right? So in the case of like athlete number one, let's say athlete number one is able to understand how to control their center of mass. So as they, in this exercise, in this example, as they approach a single leg RDL, they're able to move the pelvis through the frontal plane. They move the pelvis to the side because they can take their center of mass, which is now outside of their base of limited base support because they're on one leg, and they can take their center of mass and have it rest nicely over their base support. Right? And they can use their lateral hip musculature to sort of just calibrate and make sure it stays there. As opposed to athlete number two, same anthropometry, same thing. They tell me they feel it in their hamstring, right? So athlete number one can feel it in their glute because they can move the pelvis to the frontal plane. Athlete number two hinges, they feel it in the low hamstring and calf. This person is really, really, really falling over. Right. So here we have, you know, a sport with an issue of ACL tears or hamstring tears. And, you know, we pay attention to like, you know, we fall in the trap of strengthening. Like, oh, like Nordic hamstring curls. Everyone's talking about Nordic hamstring curls, or, you know, you watch people teach the deadlift for the, and it's like, okay, it doesn't matter. You're going to increase tissue tolerance, but you'll never be able to increase tissue tolerance to the point of managing the applied force that these athletes can apply, especially with athletes that are running, you know, 21, 22 miles an hour, which is probably translated to like a 4.3 40 yard dash. Like the level of force of someone running that fast, there's not a hamstring in the world capable of being strong enough to withstand that, right? The hamstring has to not be loaded as much, and we have to start to learn how to get into the glute and frontal plane very quickly. Right. So that's a great, that would be how I would use like a basic gait cycle principle to gauge how someone carries their center of mass. Right. And then we can use tools and external implements to start to manipulate that and learn. So you could take someone in six reps who is, I have really tight calves and my hamstrings are tight, who can't feel their hip at all. And then I can like elevate their heel or give them an anterior load, shift things that constrain them and push their center of mass back. Once I do that with zero stretching, I then get them into the right position, loading the proper tissue. And then now we can begin the motor learning process of adding progressions and regressions and adaptations and optimizations. Did I do it?
I feel like I need to, I feel like I need to hop on a plane and come and see you. It's bad because I was a triathlete and I was hit by a car and my entire, they say that you're not a real cyclist in Australia. They say you're not a real cyclist until you've been hit by a car. So, but this one got me good. So I broke so many bones, ribs gone. So it's my entire right side is always locked up, no matter what I do, paraspinals all the way up through through my shoulder play. Like it's just my entire right side and nothing I do. I mean, I say nothing I do. I'm doing probably the bare minimum of what you would suggest, but it's just horrific. I do like dry needling. But it would be great to get me back to baseline because I can only think that my entire body is like still, it's been quite some time. I got hit 2012, maybe 2011 actually. So it's been quite some time, but I'm still affected by it. I feel like I need to go back to baseline and learn this center of mass and stability work.
Yeah, there's a lot and those are the two easy ones. Like rib cage mechanics and gait cycle mechanics are the easy ones. It's the, especially with a case like that, because I think you bring up like the interesting third crux that really ties this, the biomechanical, neurobiomechanical model together. Because what I would say is, I don't like to use the word like applied biomechanics or like neurobiomechanics, because the word bio should encompass the principles of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology. Right. But biomechanics, by my estimation, has been so bastardized into like just two-dimensional stick figure drawings, right? Like these two-dimensional free body diagrams of like drawing angles and like, oh, this is the moment arm and this is the lever and this is torque and all that. It's like, my athletes don't look like this. They are not two-dimensional, right? They move through four dimensions. They move through, the triplanar models, as I mentioned, sagittal, frontal, and transverse plane, but as well as the dimension of time, right? Which is like the forgotten dimension in biomechanics. So like when we started to, because when you said like your paraspinals, everything locked up on, you say it was your right side?
Right side, yeah.
Right side. Okay. So like that to me is really telling at like a central level, right? So when I say central, I mean like at the level of the nervous system, because another bad word that the industry has taken from us, bastardized, and every time I say it, people get mad. And that word is tone. Tone is something that, especially in the manual therapy world, to be on high tone is like, it just means inefficient. So, and a lot of that processing of like, whether it's local or global tone, tone is dictated by the central nervous system, more specifically the cerebellum, right? The cerebellum is like, I'm explaining this to your listeners who haven't listened to you talk about the cerebellum, but it's like, kind of this walnut shaped movement brain that resides behind the brainstem. And it kind of has these three components, right? So it's the vestibular cerebellum, the spinal cerebellum, and the cerebrocerebellum, which all have, and we can go into more detail if you want, but they all have a role in painting a picture, and maybe not painting a picture. I like using the CGI motion capture analogy, which is like your brain has like this, this central processor. The brain is the central processor that is constantly at all times taking an inventory of peripheral sensory inputs, whether it be peripherals from your eyes or mechanoreceptors in your skin or proprioceptors in your muscle and joint capsule, and calculating this innumerable amount of data, processing it, and creating a little digital avatar in your own brain of where your body is in space. And that's prerequisite number one to knowing where to go. And that's the interesting thing with that statement of like knowing where you are is the prerequisite to knowing where like learning how to go somewhere is like true at every level of analysis of a human being. Like if you go to like cognitive behavioral therapy, that's like like a thing that they focus on is like, okay, how did you get here? Where are you? And then where do you want to, if you want to learn something in academia, like if you look at motor learning, not so much through the lens of like, I'm going to read PubMed articles and I'm going to read kinesiology textbooks. But if you literally respect it as an art of learning itself, and you look more at research, like pedagogical research about like, how is it that people actually learn things? Because we think about learning, and like, when I say learning, most people go cognitive. Math, algebra, that's just kind of math, and like, I don't know, like more cognitive processes, reading To Kill a Mockingbird. They think like, oh, learning is like this nerdy glasses pocket protector thing. But motor learning and learning, albeit different processes, like as far as the players and actors and anatomical features that are involved, but like the global principles are the same. You need to know where you are first in order to, and that's true of physiology, that's true of psychology, and it's true of motor learning and biomechanics. So like, I think that's a key piece, because when I hear, oh, I'm all locked up on an entire side of my body, that just means we have a cerebellum that's shining an inefficient beacon to all dark corners of your body, because those peripheral inputs are not illuminating these corners, right? We're not getting that. We're missing something. So what does our body do? Hey, tighten everything so we can get some sort of feedback back into the brain, right? Like imagine, you know, this room has some really shitty lighting. I apologize. But, you know, there's a couple of fluorescent lights in here. But the hallway in this building, when the power goes out, because it rains in Miami for 20 minutes, like really hard, and everyone thinks say it's going to go under, has like these massive halogen lights. They're huge. They're like the size of me. And they're blinding because there's two of them for the entire building, right? So like when they turn those things on, when there's no other lights on, it's like super inefficient. They're burning through the generator like mad, but it gets the job done. If you got to get everyone out of the building, these two things on a backup generator, it's not efficient. An efficient way of like, maybe some like candles. You ever go to a wedding and there's like just candles like all down the aisle and like, oh, this is
nice. Yeah.
Right? Yeah. It's soft, it's ambient, but you can see everything. Right, they go to like a nice restaurant that's paid attention to like those finer details, go to some Michelin joint, and it's like the lighting is perfect. You're not pulling your phone out to look at the thing, but it's ambient, it's soft, it's not taxing on the eyes. Your nervous system is kind of like that, right? Your cerebellum is kind of like that, where if it's not getting that peripheral input, it can't make a complete picture of your own movement avatar in your brain. It turns on the big lights and it puts you on high tone. Right. And that's when we start to see like these tight muscles. And if you work in the manual therapy field, like the most efficient athletes in the world, when you get them on a table and you feel their muscle, soft isn't the right word, but it's malleable, right? It's malleable because it can go from dynamics to static quickly. It doesn't live in the static state, constantly being, you know, under the orders of the central nervous system to just send some input somewhere. Or send some input out into the brain, be a reflector for this massive beacon that's shining out to like just figure out where we are. And you see it in athletics. Like you take an athlete from a table, and as you like kind of feel through like muscle tissue quality and tone, you're like, this is a really efficient athlete. This is an efficient athlete. Now the skill is completely other thing, but like the best of the best have both. They have like the trained skill and everything that goes with the development of the specific skilled sport. They have the energy systems trained and all that, but they also have that ability to know exactly where they are, right? Like a Bo Jackson comes to mind. We have a guy who's like an all-star in two separate sports at the highest level, right? He just knows where he is and can learn really quickly, right? And, you know, I'm going to use a Canadian reference. Sidney Crosby, yeah, in very good shape, very strong, like an aerobic monster, put him on a bike. But there are other guys in the league that are as fit as Sidney Crosby is for the game of hockey. But when you look at the data of him on the ice, his ability to be so efficient, or his ability to go from static to dynamic and back, to know exactly where he is, to be at state of high tone to low tone, his heartbeat in a game is like, I don't know, 20 beats per minute less than every other person on the ice, right? Because he's efficient. He doesn't have like what you have going on the right side of your body. He doesn't have this like, we need to know where everything is right now, because there was a point in time where we really didn't, when you got hit by that car and things got bad. So we're going to mobilize everything. We're going to keep it exactly in our purview. We're going to keep it in the light. I think of almost like a prison break, right? Your right side of your body is like pressed up against the wall while this giant spotlight is shining on it. And it's, if you can, it's only when you start to reinstate those peripheral and to some degree visual and to some degree motor pattern, the ambient soft lighting in all the corners of your body, that the necessity for that high tone beacon goes away. Right? The dimmer switch can turn down on that as you kind of like underlit the rest of your the rest of your awareness of where you are in space.
When it comes to fascia, okay, something we hear a lot of on social media is get the foam roller, roll out your ITB band, go for it, break up the fascia. Is that true? Is that what we're doing with foam rolling, or are we just wasting time?
Yeah, a really good question. And if you would have asked me 5 years ago, I probably would have had like a much more heated answer. But if you're a general fitness enthusiast and if something feels good, do it. Don't listen to anyone on any podcast. If it's going to keep you in the gym, do it. And that's something I probably wouldn't have said 5 years ago. But I think we misappropriate the mechanism of correction. And then when we actually start to look at, you know, these deeper level systems that I would refer to as like the basics, in this case, the peripheral sensory receptors that are going to be involved in perceiving a stimuli like a foam roller, right? There's four mechanoreceptors primarily. Right, so there's Merkel's disc, Meissner's corpuscles, Pacinian corpuscles, and Ruffini, I think. You don't need to remember what the names. They're just guys with egos that found them that I'm going to name this after me, and it's going to be. What will interest people is skin stretch, light touch, deep pressure, vibration. Right. We have other, you know, we can perceive heat through like the lateral spinal thalamic tract, but like those are kind of your main ones. That's really interesting because when we start to look at what gets propagated and what gets perpetuated in the general fitness space, we can start to like, you know, draw some pretty straight lines in between common fitness pain management interventions. And like, I think really offer an opportunity. And I've consulted with a handful of companies, like say the true thing, stop saying the fascia breakup thing, cause that's not true. But I think the truth is a way better story, right? The truth is like, okay, you know, we're eliciting some of these peripheral, you know, mechanoreceptors that feed into, you know, the peripheral mechanoreceptors feed in through like the cerebellar tract, which again, it gets a little bit complicated. I'm more than happy to go into that detail if you'd like, but it's a part of a much grander picture, right? So don't set unrealistic expectations of what this can do, but it's not nothing, right? Like peripherally in the body that feeds into the brain in the part of the cerebellum called the spinocerebellar tract, there's three inputs, and they're not all spinocerebellar, but like we have proprioception is kind of like the fastest, and we'll end there. Mechanoreception, which is like not as fast, but still important. And then we have nociception. So like nociception, some of you might be familiar with the word. It's indicative of pain, right? So nociception, pain. Nociception is like the electrical impulse transmission of things we perceive as pain. I don't want to create like a one-to-one, like nociception equals pain, because pain is like really complex. And I'm not the person to talk to about pain science. I'm the person to talk to you about, ow, my knee hurts. What does a foam roller do? Like that's kind of like the edge of my little border. Because pain is a frontal cortex mediated process, which is like, good luck unpacking like all the emotions and other shit. And it also has redundancy, like metabolic features with like substance P and all that stuff. So we're going to talk about nociception because it's way easier. Nociception is a transmission that goes peripherally into a bunch of parts of the brain, somatosensory cortex primarily. But as it goes into the brain, there's two types of pain, two speeds of pain. So there's slow pain and fast pain. Right. So like slow pain goes, I don't know, like 0.5 to 2 meters per second. And then fast pain goes 2 to 20 meters per second, which is like, hey, that's pretty good. Like fast at max velocity, Usain Bolt is probably running somewhere in the ballpark of 17 meters per second. Right. He runs 100 meters in less than 10 seconds. He's not running 10 meters per second for 10 seconds. The math isn't that easy. At max velocity, let's say at 70 meters, he's probably running 17 meters per second, which is insane. To be 17 meters away that fast is wild. Pain moves a little bit faster than that, but some of these peripheral mechanoreceptors move almost twice the speed of that, if not more. So the mechanoreceptors will clock in somewhere between, I don't know, like 35 to 70 meters per second, which is like, that's moving. But so let's look at that for a second. Let's unpack your original question and be like, is foam rolling useless to break a fascia? If we are hanging our hat and betting our farm on the fact that we will structurally deform fascia with a foam cylinder, No, I wouldn't. If that was the question at hand, no. However, and this is where biomechanics needs to get on board with the rest of medicine. Do you know this? Do you know what the drug sildenafil citrate is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you do, and you're kind of smiling, and I'm going to have to tell everyone what it is. It's like Viagra. Right, so Viagra was originally made as hypertension medication. And they're like, hold on, wait a minute. Like, what do we have here? They didn't be like, oh, okay, it didn't relieve hypertension. They're like, who said anything about hypertension? Let's put two old people in a bathtub, run the cameras, and let's sell the shit out of this little blue pill. So it's like, let's not a traditional vasodilator.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Like, let's look at this mechanistically and be like, okay, yeah, no, it does not break up fascia, it doesn't break up scar tissue. However, it might stimulate one of the four mechanoreceptors, and they're hard to parse out. A lot of them do both. But the interesting thing with one of them is they actually exist in bone, which is like pretty wild. And so there's a mechanoreceptor there's two that are like really subcutaneous. That's obviously going to be like light touch. And I think, what's the other one? Light touch and like vibration. But one of them, deep pressure, exists. That deep pressure, free nerve ending, lives deeper under the layers of the skin, but also in the layer of the bone. So if you have like a really hard foam roller, it's like you might be getting into, depending on the size of your quads or hamstrings, you might be getting into actually putting pressure on the femur. And that's not, again, is that the silver bullet? No, it exists in this little list of 9 peripheral mechanoreceptors in this little component of the spinocerebellum that sits next to another giant component of the cerebrocerebellum and another massive component of the vestibular cerebellum. So when we can draw a giant, when we look at the big picture and be like, this is just doing this, if this is in accordance with trying to fill in and illuminate our little avatar image by understanding and being able to, as strategic as we can, elicit stimuli across all three of these major subcategories that create this avatar image, then it's totally fine. I mean, but again, people get stuck in mechanisms, right? We love to be right. We love things that make sense when we don't think about it. That's the thing with foam rolling. It makes sense if you don't think about it. But when you think about it, you're like, okay, that's not mechanistically what's happening. But I've been in the weirdest gyms all over the world. And so help me God, in the most remote places I've ever been, I've been in a cave in the middle of Turkey training. And God bless, there's a foam roller in the corner. It wouldn't be there if it wasn't effective. It's just people don't like to look at the mechanism. So that's like long answer to a short question, but I'm sure you're used to that by now.
How do you feel about ice baths?
Just don't videotape and put it on Instagram. That's why my only ask. I don't dare.
This is going direct to a reel.
Sick. Do it. I don't care. All right. So it's interesting. Let's unpack this a little bit, because it is something that, depending on like the resting tone of an athlete, be something that I look at. There's a process that happens at length. So let's circle back to breathing, for example, or for a start. So breathing is a unique process as it exists both in the autonomic and voluntary aspects of our nervous system. And this entire time, we've been breathing and not really paying much attention to it. But if we could, we could override that. Now, let's think, for example, about what's another autonomic process? Like gastric emptying is an autonomic process. Like, we don't need to think about like the process of peristalsis, right? Which is like how we like digest food and move it through our GI tract. We don't need to think about that. Thank God. Because I have like enough stuff to think about. I'd like to set up this camera and this mic, and I couldn't hear you at first. Imagine also like, oh God, I need to think about like moving food through my GI tract. Like, it'd be a nightmare. So when we look at like the sympathetic and parasympathetic states and the different processes that are autonomically triggered by being in either state, and let's take it out to the nth degree so it's really simple. If we look at sympathetic, which is fight or flight, what happens? Well, your pupils will dilate massively, right? To get in as much light as possible. Your peripheral blood flow will decrease to drive blood to the central organs, right? Then there'll be like a norepinephrine, epinephrine response that triggers a lot of this. So when norepinephrine, epinephrine starts signaling very efficiently to all these processes, they all sort of happen. And one thing that'll happen is there will probably be a stark inhalation as a consequence of that, right? Like, I was in the Bahamas once and some guy broke into my Airbnb. And the first thing I did was, in accordance with 10,000 other processes in my body, freak the fuck out. Like, dude, what is this Bahamian guy coming through the back door? It's like I just grabbed a spoon and chased him naked through an alleyway. That's all I had. But what I didn't do, and this is kind of like, I'll return back to the ice bath thing, is I didn't have a sigh of relief, right? Like, I'm sure when you were going through school and you got like application back that you were, that you got in, there's like a sigh of relief. So here we have like exhalation, which is like associated with an autonomic process, a parasympathetic response, and inhalation, which is sort of tied in with an autonomic sympathetic response. Every other process that happened with that, you know, that sharp inhalation when the Bahamian man came through my backsliding door of my Airbnb, and every other autonomic response that happened with my, like, that relief that came when I got it accepted into grad school, I can't make any of those other things happen. I can make inhalation and exhalation happen. So that's like the unique thing about breathing, is that we can go through, and it's called respiratory sinus arrhythmia is like the technical term, right? Which is basically the switch between sympathetic and parasympathetic through inhalation, exhalation. This is the science behind HRV, right? So heart rate variability is going to be like how much fluctuation in variability in, or how much fluctuation in, you know, heart rate throughout the day do you see? And you actually want like a good robust recovered nervous system is going to see, you know, a good delta. We don't want like super high peaks. We don't want super low valleys. The goal is to actually just see like a really nice delta, like an ability to go high, because this expresses variability on the whole. So to your original question, ice baths as like a method of recovery, it's like for someone who, you know, who is of low tone, someone who doesn't like, and this is honestly strange, like if I honk a car horn at someone and they're like, oh, dude, you're wired a little bit tight, maybe I put them in the ice bath, right? Because what do you see when someone gets in an ice bath and they're in high tone? What are they trying to do? Inhale, 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 right? Because sympathetic, 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 sympathetic. Well, it's like, if we can teach how to forcefully exhale, because I think this is something that gets missed in the process, just like an exercise. Like, you know, we understand now, like, exercise has certain technique parameters that we probably want to stay within. Right. Like, not that exercise is at all inherently dangerous. It's probably one of the more safer activities you could do. But, you know, if you're deadlifting, it's like, okay, there's a certain range of spinal flexion depending on your skill that we find acceptable as a range of normal. There's like a technical component to the effective mechanism of an ice bath that I think oftentimes gets missed. Because if your teeth start chattering, you're done. You're done. The technique is broken down. Because the idea is to have a stimulus that challenges your ability to stay parasympathetic, to drive a full exhale, right? To be able to parasympathetically control an acute bout of sympathetic stress, right? So that's the goal. But when I see people on Instagram for like 3 minutes, like chattering their teeth, it's like, you've succumbed to the sympathetic stimulus, right? That's like just getting pinned under like a 500-pound squat. It's like, why are you putting this up? This is ridiculous.
So, is that negating the effects if you're just going to be in so much sympathetic tone?
Well, I mean, it depends on if your goal is to have something to post on Instagram, if your goal is to actually derive a physiological benefit. To me, it would be like, you're done. That's like whatever the stopwatch says, that's the benchmark that we need to beat, right? So graded exposures is, you know, people are so quick to just dive into the ocean. It's like, listen, Wim, like, let's take it easy and let's start with like maybe turning the shower down a little bit. Cause I don't take my clients and put them under 500-600-pound barbells right away, right? Graded exposure. So that's my take on it. Understand, like, with my, again, I'm not, this isn't like a particular subspecialty of mine, but understanding, you know, a little basic level, superficial level of that respiratory sinus arrhythmia, like, you know, cardiovascular, neurocardiovascular physiology, I would say once we start losing control of that parasympathetic, we've kind of like, we've broken the technique as far as I'm concerned. And then, but that's totally fine, right? Like everyone has a threshold for adapting or coping to any stimulus or overcoming any stimulus. The goal then is like, how do we grade exposures to then further that ability to withstand stress?
Yeah, it's almost as if we are viewing so many different modalities for health on Instagram. You know, let's jump into the ice bath, let's get into the saunas. And I always mention that we're forgetting to do baseline activities. You know, we're just going for the supplement. We're going for the Theragun. I don't know what you think about Theraguns, but we're just going for the dangly, sexy things on top without doing the baseline work. So in saying that, what are some of the things that we need to be doing for recovery?
Exercise programming, without a doubt.
Okay. It's
like, to me, that's such a, what are you recovering from? And look, and like, I'm going to take like the less hard stance, more human approach. And I kind of double back to something I said earlier. If you enjoy something, do it. I'll deploy. And I got this from like a few friends of mine, like Corey Schlesinger, who's the strength coach for the Phoenix Suns. I think he probably got this from Buddy Morris, if I do recall correctly, who's like a legendary strength coach. Buddy and Corey had this idea of a constraints model of recovery tools, which in essentially I've used this and I really like it. I'll tell like an athlete. And I think there's two conversations to be had here. One is like, you're a weekend warrior. You're trying to stay in shape. You want to walk your daughter down the aisle when you're older, whatever your motivations are to stay in shape. And the other is like, you're going to make hundreds of millions of dollars playing a sport, which is like, I'll tend to be more suggestive and more persuasive to the people who have more on, I don't say more on the line, like I can relate the two end results to one another, but athletes seem to be a little bit more like straight to the brow line. Yes, sir. No, sir. Like they'll do whatever it takes. And, you know, there's a different relationship with exercise as a professional athlete than with the general fitness population. So if at any point a statement I've made seems a little too absolute for someone, that's the divide I'd like to refer back to, because, you know, I talk a lot with pro athletes all day. So I don't want them to be taken as like, you have to do this. You have to do what makes you happy. That, and I can't tell you how important that is with exercise. Like creating a good relationship with exercise emotionally is like the number one thing. So if you like foam rollers, you like Theraguns, if you like posting videos of yourself at an ice bath on Instagram, dude, I'm here for it. If that's what makes you happy, like I'll like that shit all day. Now, if I have an athlete who's paying me X and, you know, they get paid Y and there's contracts and sponsors and this will set up generational wealth for their family forever, and that's like the what's at stake, and they go, what is the best thing to do, then I'm going to be like, okay, their happiness is tied to the end result. This is the most expedient way to get to said end result based off of some of these principles. So that, I think that's like a big thing to parse out of the gate. So much so that I've actually forgot your original question.
I was asking what the best recovery methods are.
Okay. Oh yeah. So programming, I think programming is a big thing to pay attention to, because an injury, like the recovery industry, like on the whole, has stemmed from this idea that, you know, we need to recover from exercise. Now, most people don't need to necessarily recover from the exercise. They need to recover from exercise's role in aggregating stress in their entire body with their entire life. So I think that's like thing number one to parse out is, if you have a membership to a big commercial gym, I'm going to go and say that you're not setting yourself up to train to failure. You probably don't, you know, and I don't want to sound arrogant saying this, you're probably not training to failure by the definition of what failure would mean from like an actual stimulus perspective to stimulate, you know, a bunch of satellite cells and processes that affect hormones and muscle proteins, and the whole nine yards. So exercise programming is something that is very simple, and in so that it's not marketable. And this is where like having a little bit of ownership goes a long way in managing or monitoring and managing your stress, at the very least the stress that is applied through exercise. But the rest of your 168 hours in a week, let's say on a good week, people might spend 6 hours in the gym, right? So like that's relatively not a ton of time. But if it's going to be increasingly higher stress, you need to kind of document your performance. And I think that's like the metric that everyone misses. They're so quick to look at an Apple Watch or a Whoop band or an Aura ring, and nothing against any of these fitness wearables and any ones that I didn't mention, but performance is our proxy for decision-making. And that should indicate the level of recovery that we necessitate. But the first thing we should look to do when performance isn't increasing or performance is depreciating is we should manage load. We should manage the acute bouts of stress that we put ourselves in those small windows in that 168-hour week where we are purposely going through, because that's the biggest opportunity to begin to offset and augment the amount of recovery tools that we need. Because recovery is still a stimulus. It's still a stimulus that needs, like, you know, if I had to say a favorite recovery tool, and this is like really pertinent to me and my clientele, is no screens, dark room, nothing, like no music, like go completely, like, because that's a common concussion protocol, right? It's like get out of input and output. Like that's true recovery. And like to a certain degree, sleep, but you got to be careful with sleep after like acute head trauma and things like that. But I think for a general population, what was the word Gabby used? NARP? I don't quite know if I use that in the proper context.
Never heard that before in my life.
Now, Gabby Lyons used some word the other day, and I've tried to use it in context. I don't think I did. Normal, athletic, real person or something like that. If you're a general fitness
athlete, okay.
I think having an idea of your overall, maybe not overall tonnage, but like going in and being, oh, last time I did this on this exercise, and doing repeated bouts of that and documenting your progress and of actual performance is going to be such a good starting point in, you know, mitigating and managing the amount of recovery you need to do, because it's going to be able to document and kind of have a black box of the stress that you're under, so that when you aren't recovering, you can adjust your stimulus accordingly, right? And you can change your exercise program. And this works both ways, right? Some days you go in the gym and you feel really good. Some days you don't. Look, sometimes like the best lifts I've ever had are days I don't feel good, but I don't use my feeling as a proxy. I use my performance as a proxy, right? So I videotape a set or something. It's like, oh, okay, that deadlift felt heavy and felt slow, but objectively it moved fast. I will defer to that performance to make my decision about whether to continue on in my workout. And that's a sense of ownership that can be difficult, but I think that should be at the very least a goal for people who are getting into fitness, is to establish that type of autonomy and ownership over the acute bouts of stress that they're willingly putting themselves under. Because a lot of the stuff outside the gym, we don't ask for it, right? A lot of the stress is like, your kid did whatever at school, or, you know, my phone company is like a different thing now, and my automated payment and my service is like, whatever. Like, that was just this morning. Like, we don't choose that. But here we have a little window of control, which is like maybe one of the reasons I love exercise so much, because it's like the one thing in my life I could control, is everything else just spirals like crazy. But that's so important, because we can start to manipulate that. And really, you know, if you find yourself leaning towards these tools, I would strip it back to like, what am I doing? What am I doing in the gym to necessitate this Humpty Dumpty putting back together weekly process of like compression boots and Theraguns and foam rollers and, you know, ice baths and all that. So exercise programming is like a bit of an unconventional answer. And it's really like a lifetime pursuit of understanding your, you know, the demands that, or the consequences of the demands you put on your body willingly, and how they interact with the unwitting demands that kind of fly in from our day-to-day life. Because stress is an aggregate, right? It all comes together. It responds physiologically very similar. But the control over that piece is free, right? And I think that's like a really important note for people to work towards. And that'll keep you engaged in fitness forever. Number one, to knowing where to go. And that's like, and the interesting thing with that statement of like knowing where you are is the prerequisite to knowing where like learning how to go somewhere, is like true at every level of analysis of a human being. Like if you go to like cognitive behavioral therapy, that's like,
we definitely share the same belief on that. A really great book that just came to mind was The Body Keeps the Score. And it really speaks about what you were talking about. So, but we've just reached our 1 hour, Jordan. I think I asked you like 4 questions in that entire hour. I loved it. We definitely have to do a part two. Let me just ask you before we take people to your social media, you've got a wonderful course. So you're out there, you're actually educating people on proper biomechanics. I haven't done your course, but I'd love to know a bit more about it. And when is your next intake?
Yeah, so I founded Prescript with a business partner of mine 8 years ago. So like our flagship course is like our level one, which is applied biomechanics and functional anatomy 1. So we have level one, which the intake is currently live, and the next semester will start beginning of March. I should really know this often. I have much smarter people working on that side of the business. But so we have level one, which is live biomechanics. That worries more about like shoulder, hip, and spine. Level two, which is obviously like our more advanced course, covered a little bit more like level two stuff here, which is like rib cage, ventilation mechanics, pelvis gait cycle mechanics, and then diving into the central nervous system, primarily cerebellar function. We also have like a nutrition arm to the company. So we have nutrition for sports performance, which is headed up by actually an Aussie, Phil Smith. And we have nutrition for body composition, who like our head of our nutrition program, Dr. Dwayne Jackson. He heads up that. We have a skill acquisition and motor learning course. We have an exercise programming course, which is currently live. I'm going to miss one. We have a breathing fundamentals course, which is offered annually, and the registration is up on the website. We have an Olympic weightlifting course, our barbell course, which is one of our most popular, which goes over like applied biomechanics and functional anatomy of the big three lifts, progressions, regressions, adaptations, and optimization for squat, bench, and dead. I think that's all of them, but I could be wrong. So all that is on our website, www.pre-script.com.